Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Hey guys, the following episode of Monsteropolis includes spoilers for Momo the Missouri Monster. So if you have not seen it, we did our best to keep some of the vital story elements out, but a few things slip in. So if you have not seen Momo and you don't want anything spoiled, you might want to skip this episode for a couple weeks. I'm not encouraging you to skip the episode. I think you should listen to it, but just be warned. Thanks.
They were enjoying themselves until they smelled something strange. Something really strong and pungent, and heard some rustling amongst the tree line. They screamed, the Doris looked out the bathroom window and saw a creature.
One thing that I recollect, this thing was supposedly large and it was supposedly hairy.
So it was in 1975, a film crew set out to make a movie about another famous hairy monster, Momo, Missouri's own monster. The film crew shot and edited the film,
but for some unknown reason, never released it. I cut it off before Cliff's great monologue there. This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my friend.
That's me, Mark Matzke.
And Monsteropolis is, of course, the official show of Small Town Monsters. Each week we talk about whatever topic relating to the unexplained suits our fancy. This week we're talking about a movie we made together as one.
Before this week, you will refer to me as the Reverend Charles B. Pierce? McCullough.
Okay, that's right. We wanted to talk, though, real quick, tonight, midnight. So if you're hearing this on Friday, September 6th, head out your door right now. We are screening the premiere of Momo the Missouri Monster takes place tonight. September 6th at midnight at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington, Kentucky. Tickets $7. Come see it. I'll be there. Seth, I'll be there. Mark won't be there. Cliff and Bobo will both be there. Nick Groff will be there. Zach and Jason will also be there from Small Town Monsters. So it's going to be a nice little... Oh, you know who else is going to be there from... she's a Small Town Monsters family. Ellie. Our buddy Ellie will be there. So Eleanor Haskins will be there. And Ellie is a her boyfriend is also Harry will also be there. And Harry is definitely part of the SDM crew because he shot all of the B-roll that was in the Chicago sequence of Terror in the Skies. And he'll also be there. So you can meet any of us tonight.
Did you get that owl B-roll, the bar?
That's right outside where they live, actually.
That's cool.
Yeah. What else do we got? We have next weekend, Friday, September 13th, we are showing Momo at the Canton Palace Theater in Canton, Ohio. The doors open at 7, movie starts at 7:30. Most of the crew will be there, this is one of the few times I can say that. Most of the crew and most of the cast will be there. The only exception would be like Lyle. And, you know, like, so, you know, Elizabeth Saint will actually be there. Janet Jay will probably be there. So a lot of the people that are involved in the making of the movie, Mark and I will both be there. Andy will be there. Is Sue going to be there?
Sue will be there.
Sue's in the movie.
Yeah.
She'll be there. So pretty much a lot of the largest number of cast and crew that will assumedly gather for a screening of this movie will be there.
Remind me to ask you about the crazy board from Momo. When we get off of this,
I should bring that to the event. Is that what you were going to ask me about?
Well, yeah.
What I'm going to do with it?
The final destination of the crazy board. Because it's in our house right now.
Is it?
Yeah.
I'd like it to go in the STM museum whenever we get around to doing that. So for now, probably.
Well, I will make sure it's not destroyed then.
Unless you want to. Is it in your guys' way?
No.
Yeah, let's talk about this on the show.
Okay.
What room is it in?
Well, it's in my bathroom right now.
No, I mean, you sit there and you look at it. Okay.
The river.
The September 20th, we're at the State Theater in Point Pleasant, West Virginia for a screening of Terror in the Skies and Momo, the Missouri Monster. The 20th is also the official release date of Momo. Come see us at the Mothman Festival all weekend, but we're help kicking it off with that event. I got to mention real quick, if you do come for that event, make sure you get there early. We're expecting anywhere from 5,000 to 9,000 people in a theater that seats 300. So you're going to want to get there early to guarantee a seat and also bring a fan because it's hot. I think that is the catch up. I tried to breeze through it after last week. Okay, so this episode is all about Mark and I sort of fondly looking back on Momo, the Missouri Monster. It's probably going to be a little formatless and more of a free-flowing conversation about the creation of the movie. So,
Here's this tweet question.
Yes.
Okay.
Do that first.
This is from our buddy Hawk Nato, who we got to hang out with a little bit a year ago at the at the conference.
Yeah.
Who sporting the Bob Gimlin tat. So he do you think the discovery of Sasquatch will impact forestry, hunting, fishing, camping, land purchase, etc.? Love the podcast.
That's if it's discovered, right?
It is, yeah. The way the question is framed, it's assuming
that
it's inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, if it is discovered, then yes, there would be dramatic implications on everything, you would assume, right? I mean, like, your logging industry is going to be severely hampered, especially in public or in those government controlled lands, I would assume. And there's going to be areas set up. I mean, like, I think the closest thing you could look for like a comparison would be what happened when they found that ivory-billed woodpecker a couple of years ago. Is that what it is?
Spotted owl.
Spotted owl.
Well, and that brings
the Michigan
up
cougar.
It does. It brings up the biological question of what's it going to be identified as? Because if it's an animal, it's one thing. But what if is it more Homo sapiens?
Oh, get out of here, Mark. Come on. Don't bring it's that crap on my
It's just another tribe of person. So what do you do then? But I think that sets up a series I would really like to do, which is sort of the day after series where we would do, you know, the day after.
Day after disclosure.
Disclosure, yeah.
That'd be really cool.
I got a great book, which is why this is on my mind, by Richard Dolan called AD.
Yeah.
After disclosure. And he goes, I mean, he's thought the whole thing through. And I think it would be a lot of fun to talk about that. And then we could do a day after Kathy Strain pulls Bigfoot out of Area X.
Yeah, what's going to happen? Dead Bigfoot body up. Day after ghosts are proven to exist. Day after time travel is proven to exist. Okay, so let's talk about the creative process of Momo. And for maybe really quickly, sum up, keeping in mind that most of the audience listening has not seen the movie, sum up what the movie is about.
Ooh.
And maybe even like sort of talk a little bit about the story, like how we tell the story.
Yeah. Well, on a macro level, the Momo, the Missouri Monster, is about how stories are preserved, and especially in the modern setting, the role that cinema has in keeping certain stories alive and emphasizing certain points that may or may not jibe with reality, with what really happened. Mm. And the tension that's there and the lasting effects of a story, if it's committed to a kind of a cultural memory, the lasting effects of that on a community. And so what we've done with this particular film is played around with that in by writing our own homage to the Sasquatch plantation genre of the 70s and 80s, and interspersing that with actual documentary film that was captured by the crew, and Lyle narrates that portion of it. And we even blur the lines with that by making his portion be sort of a callback to the cable access days of having your own show, and or the independent horror host almost, which was sort of the original earliest stage idea, was to even make it more of a horror host situation.
Right.
And so we kind of intersperse that and go back and forth between this portion of the film and how does that square with the reality of the situation as described by eyewitnesses.
Yeah, and so just jumping right into that part of it, like the horror host and the message. This is an interesting movie for me because it's one of the first where I don't agree with the ultimate message of the film, which is, it's there are lines I wrote. I wrote Lyle's stuff. But there's a message, and I'm not going to talk about what it is, but at the end of the movie, Lyle kind of sums up his final thoughts. And I think it's probably reflective of Lyle and like Lyle's own opinions on those things. It's not necessarily an idea or a message that I agree with 100%. I do think there's a value in those, like Legend of Boggy Creek, in keeping these stories alive. I just don't necessarily agree with the idea of like throw it all out and whatever's left is fine because it's keeping the story alive. I don't necessarily identify with that idea. But so what I want to talk about is that the initial creation of the script, and this is like the first time we've ever done this and I just talked about this on Friday, but this is the first time we've as a crew come up with a film together. It's the first time. It's never happened before. Probably won't happen again unless like we're playing even more with like the narrative side of things. This only happened this way because of that.
Right.
There was an initial meeting, and you can correct my timeline on this because I might be messed up. There was an initial meeting with me and Jason and Zach and Mark, or not Mark. You weren't there. Adam and Adrian. So there's five of us. We met at my house. But this is where I get confused. I think that me and Jason had met before that, and then you and me and Jason met, right?
Yeah, that's the sequence is those two meetings first.
And then the big meeting.
Right.
Right?
No, then us.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I got you. Okay, so there was a meeting with Jason and I where we came up scene by scene the entire movie start to finish. That was just the narrative portion of the film, nothing else. So Jason and I sat down and it took like 3 hours and we just sat at the office and kind of came up with like this scene bleeds into this scene, goes into this scene. And then there was the meeting with everyone, and that was the meeting where Jason came up with the idea of the host being sort of a horror host.
Yeah.
And that terrified me because I had always thought of Lyle's scenes as being a way to anchor the narrative, because you're coming out of this maybe even more over the top in its original sort of conception than how it ended up being in the final film.
Yeah.
You were coming out of this sort of over the top narrative film into these sequences that were going to be narrated just by Lyle, basically Lyle Blackburn, like Boggy Creek Monster style, except he would be talking directly to the camera, which would then go into the documentary portion of the film.
Right.
And, then Jason came up with this idea of like him being this, like you had said, almost like an over the top horror host.
Right.
And that really concerned me from the start because I realized, and this is how it ended up being, by the way, but I realized that you were going to be playing with three different tones. So in each of them is going, each sequence, each storytelling style is going to have its own tone. And is that going to feel really disjointed to an audience to go from these like, sequences of Lyle, what is that? It just keeps popping. these sequences of Lyle in character as this host, talking to the camera, going into the narrative, coming back out and being in a very real world small town monsters, straight ahead documentary. I would put the documentary portions of this movie back on the plane of like Boggy Creek Monster in terms of not quality. Like the quality is great. There's like really good sound design. The sound recording is fantastic. It's some of the best, you know, audio quality, the way it looks and everything. But as far as like a scaled back documentary, we don't have the really like in your face animated sequences, and there's no right. There's no recreations during those sequences. The only recreations in the movie are the narrative, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Right.
There's some soft animated sequences, yeah, but nothing
exactly,
nothing like Chris Scout. So in a way, it was almost like a step back to the older style of doing mm-hmm. it. But how would all those things go together, and would it work? And there was a point after the final cut of the movie where I was still concerned about that. Mm-hmm. It was because like you just can't, as someone who's so in the middle, in the thick of things, it's very hard to see if everything's going to work. But we had those meetings. We had the big meeting with everyone. The only thing I remember about that second meeting is that Jason came up with the idea of the horror host. I think other than that, most of what was going on that day was centered around sort of putting the pieces in place as far as like who would play what role, you know, like logistics relating to this. I think we came up with the shooting schedule. Mm-hmm. And then you, Jason, and I sat down and talked about the movie. And then the script went to you, and Mark wrote the entire movie, literally, like outside of the story, which was put together by Jason. Mark wrote the entire script in over the span of what, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
Yeah, about 2 weeks, beginning to end.
2 weeks, the whole script came to me. And then I passed it off to Jason, and Jason did his first pass through. And the one thing I remember about that is Jason changed nothing of yours. I don't think. I think all Jason did was add to the opening sequence, and then he would add here or there, but I don't think he changed anything. And then it came to me, and I adjusted some things and rewrote a couple lines or something, but for the most part, it remained the same throughout. Mm-hmm. So the coolest thing about this movie to me has been, from a writing standpoint, it was like the most collaborative thing I've done, because I didn't feel like anyone was bristling at the work someone else was doing. It was like we came up with a story, passed it to you. You get to do all the dialogue and all that stuff, and you know, like add some things here and there. And some things, what's crazy is if you watch the movie, it is what we wrote. There's a few adjustments, you know, like Lyle's character changed slightly. The fishing scene didn't make the movie, even though we have the end of that scene shot. Mm-hmm. Which someday we might have to put as like an extra on something, because it was actually the first scene we shot with Adam and the boys together.
Yeah.
And I think they actually did pretty good in that scene, because it's a very dramatic scene. Mm-hmm. It was a hard scene to start them off. But yeah, it was like, to me, it was a very collaborative experience. And normally, this is probably an indictment on me more than anything, but like that word is scary to me in some ways, because I feel like I work really well under pressure by myself, frantically trying to kick myself into getting things done. But I'm not good with planning. I've never been good with any kind of pre-production or planning, but this was, I don't know, this one was different. And it might just be the fact that it's a narrative, and the nature of that is that you have to do a lot of planning.
Right. Right. And it was fun in the sense of, for me, one of the goals that I had was to try and embed as much or as many tip of the cap type moments to some of the Legend of Boggy Creek and Creature from Black Lake. And that typically ended up being, you know, references to people or places that are thrown in there. So if you have a background in Sasquatch Ploitation movies, hopefully you pick up on some of them, because a lot of those touches survived the final script and actually got into the film, which, like you said, the collaborative process was really a lot of fun, because you kind of see what ends up in it, you know, what rises to the top and stays part of it. So that is just a lot of moving parts.
I was going to try to find the prayer meeting so I could play a quick sequence from that. But there are a number. So one thing Kelly asked me that I couldn't immediately call to mind, but how much of, like, give us some examples of the Easter eggs that are hidden in the movie for like an audience that's going to watch it. Like, give us an audience idea of what they'd be looking for.
Sure. Well, there's a portion of, a lot happens during the posse scene, actually. There's a couple lines of dialogue about Charlie Pierce's prize shows. That comes right out of the first couple minutes of Legend of Boggy Creek, kind of combining, of course, the director's name and one of the lines that is really striking near the beginning, where, you know, what kind of creature could pick up 200-pound hogs and walk off with them? So it's just a direct callback to that. Mm-hmm.
The boogeyman, we saw the boogeyman, yeah. That was one Brandon caught over the weekend. He watched A Creature from Black Lake for the first time and caught that.
Yep.
There was originally a callback to the Coke line, the Coke line from, and that got cut because I can't remember where that was that got cut.
Yeah. It just got left out.
Yeah.
But probably my favorite, the one that I hoped would end up in the most was, a Bobo's character saying, there's something on the hill.
Yeah. But he ad-libbed.
He ad-libbed. It makes it better. I was like, that kicks it up.
Yeah. And we won't spoil that line, but it's one of my favorites in the movie. Okay. So there's a throwback to Paho from Creature from Black Lake. And it's that kind of stuff like sprinkled throughout the entire movie. And it's not, I feel like it's cool because it's not intrusive. If you're a fan of those movies, you're going to catch a lot of these little nods, especially there's an entire sequence in the movie that I call the Legend of Boggy Creek chapter. Because like the movie split and the narrative split into these little sections. And there's a part where Edgar starts getting calls from people who are seeing the monster. And it goes through, I think there's three in that sequence. There's there's Wendorf. There's Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Who I just got an update on his whereabouts in my email the other day.
Oh.
He's in Arizona now. Address is no, Bill O'Reilly, and then the Sudderth garden scene, right? The Sudderths, no, that's not then yet. It originally was. See, that scene's been moved around,
right?
Because originally that scene went at the end of that sequence, and then that was there because of the fact that later we had the fishing scene. But I ended up using the Sudderth scene as a segue into the posse sequence.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a lot of nods to like Legend of Boggy Creek and Creature from Black Lake, especially. And I think like, the thing I go back to the most is Jason and I talked during the creation of the movie the most about, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, because I sort of saw Edgar in a way as being similar to Richard Dreyfuss' character from Close Encounters, where maybe not Richard Dreyfuss' character basically just becomes obsessed with discovery and like these alien beings and that sort of thing. And I think Edgar's much more geared around like protecting his family and that's why the obsession starts or grows rather than, you know, like any desire to know if Bigfoot's real. But that was the movie that Jason and I talked the most about. And even like we talked about it the night we shot the dinner table sequence and the scene right after when the family leaves.
Right.
Those were seen as our Close Encounters moments, like where you have this family drama sort of unfolding. And can we talk for real quickly? And I'm sure when Adam's on the show, we'll get to this, but like what a great job everyone involved in the making of the movie did, like the actors, because other than like Elizabeth Saint and Janet, I don't know that anyone in the movie would sort of label themselves as an actor or actress. Like, I think most of them were excited about the opportunity to try that. And some of them do have experience with that. But if you look at what they were dealing with in terms of like a crazy script that is very, very strange. I mean, it's dealing with some really weird subject matter. I think everyone did a really outstanding job. I've been told by multiple people that my dad's Wendorf sequences are there. Kai loved my dad as Wendorf.
Yeah.
It's one of his favorite parts in the movie. But and the one I had to go back to, and I'm not just saying this cause you're here, but your part as the Reverend is one of my favorite sequences in the movie.
That's cool.
It just feels that feels so 70s to me. And I don't think the interesting thing about that is neither Jason or I saw that sequence going that way.
Okay.
Until you started doing that. And then like that just felt like a very hokey scene to me, the way it was in the script, in a good way, like not bad hokey, but I mean it felt kind of like 70s hokey to me. Like, and you took it in another direction where that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, it was honestly kind of spooky hearing you recite the lines.
Right. Right. And that was, as I was writing it, that's really what, cause I didn't know I would be doing that, but whoever was going to be saying those lines really had to be disturbed because they were putting stuff together.
Yeah.
You know, they were interpreting things a certain way and it was kind of shaking them up. So that I'm glad that kind of came across.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of fun. Yeah, you're right. I mean, everybody involved, I thought, did an excellent job. It was for the how short relatively the film is, there's a lot of dialogue. I mean, there's, and I think from a writing standpoint, there has to be enough dialogue for it to sound believable. Because we were never going for sort of a hokey, poke each other in the ribs sort of.
The direction was always from the beginning that we had to play that part of the movie straight. And just given the nature of what we were doing on the budget we had with the fact that so many of the people are non-actors, there would be an inherent, I don't know the word to use because cheesiness isn't right, but there would be an inherent authentic, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
I do.
B-movie vibe to
right.
it that's built into it just because of the nature of what we're doing.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, because we using these films as a template, I mean, The Legend of Boggy Creek and Creature from Black Lake that we keep going back to, the tone of those is completely earnest. Like, this story, we're just going to put it out there, and it's not campy, and it's not like, oh, look at these, how crazy this is. It's playing it really straight. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, use that form, have a couple nods in there to people who know the stuff like we do, but to really let that story just be what it is and a little over the top because that's just the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll just say this now. It's so close to what we saw, I think, in our heads. That's the most startling thing to me.
That's the strangest part of it.
Sitting here now today, it's like, that's extremely close to the movie I saw in my head.
Yeah.
I don't know how often that happens, but it happened in this case.
If you had played it over the top or you had people going way, way too, you know, like really ham it up on camera or something, it would have either become a comedy or it would have become dramatically annoying or, you know, like very annoying and cloying to watch that sort of thing. And I've seen examples of that happening we didn't want it to be a parody was the thing.
Right.
We wanted those scenes to have, even though our monster isn't the, you know, I'm trying to think, it's not the creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that, you know, like it still needed to feel kind of scary. And there are like the final shot in the movie's cheesy. The scene with Will when he first sees the monster was purposely created that way. So I was fine with the filmmaking being over the top and cheesy, but as far as like the acting goes, they were all just playing it straight. My favorite shot one of my favorite acting moments in the movie was Graydon. Have I showed you the scene where he, okay. So Graydon, you were there for it. final scene in the movie, they're all looking at the UFOs coming into the sky. Spoiler alert. Graydon has a line about, "See, Dad, now I can tell the kids at school that you're a monster hunter."
Yeah.
And he almost falls over. And I just got caught up in the moment or something, and he almost tripped over his own feet. And but it was his best line delivery. Like, he did a pretty good job of delivering the line. So that outtake is amazing, because immediately after he says it, he almost falls over. And like, there were all kind of like fun little like scenes like that with him and Will. I mean, what, you know, like, especially with them, Graydon's acted in plays and stuff, but Will has no idea of how to be an actor. And I thought, considering all the lines they had and they're carrying some of the most dramatic moments of the movie, they're doing really good.
Right.
You know, like, and if we had been telling them to wink at the audience or something, I think it would have ruined the whole, the whole impact of those scenes.
Yeah. We asked a lot of the kids.
Yeah.
And we asked a lot of Adam.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure that we get that said too.
Physically.
Yeah, exactly.
Physically, Adam got pretty badly hurt actually on the last, on the filming of the posse sequence in the Bonehouse scene. You actually see the clip in the trailer. It's when he jumps down off the brick wall into the Bonehouse. He couldn't see the ground. And when he thought he was higher up than he was. So when he was preparing himself for a longer fall.
Oh.
And so when he hit the ground, he immediately went down on his head.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was 4:30 in the morning. Very cold. It was down into the low 40s by then. And we were all soaking wet. He had fallen in the grass earlier running, which is also another shot. I think that's in the trailer.
Right.
So yeah, Adam had to do a ton of, not just lines, but the physical toll after that first weekend, especially, was probably pretty intense for him.
Yeah. Yep. And he did a good job, I thought, of, you know, sort of the, we talked about this before, the stoic 70s hero.
Yeah.
You know, Charles Bronson pops into my head, but you know,
I was thinking, what's this, the guy in Creature from Black Lake, not Paho, the other
Reeves.
One. Hey, it's Reeves. Yeah, he's got that same kind of like,
he does.
Yeah. Like stoic 70s guy. I will go back to that. This will be one that I'm very much looking forward to watching, with an audience.
Yeah.
You know, like, so it's the first STM movie that is, was geared for fun. You know, like it's got a lot of funny moments. It's got a lot of like jump scares. But it is packaged around that documentary, and the documentary plays a vital role in keeping the whole thing grounded. You know, like, this is reality. Like, these are actual things that happened. And I said, not too long into the process, I thought this would go down as the quintessential small town monsters movie, because to me, it's the first STM movie that plays entirely the way the initial Small Town Monsters book proposal was proposed, where it is about a town and how the town is impacted by the event. And we didn't have any of the Harrisons to talk about their incident. So what you get is townspeople talking about how it impacted Louisiana, Missouri on the whole. So to me, it was always going to be the one that maybe people think of as a Small Town Monsters movie. What was that?
Yeah, but it really does. It sets the paradigm that we've always talked about, which is, you know, initial encounter, stories spread, other people have experiences, and it all leads up to a posse going out looking for something. And then the fallout from that, you know, what happens after when nothing is found, what happens to the families, the sort of the community memory, do they embrace it or not? And I personally, these are some of the best interviews to me in this film, because of the, I'm sort of haunted by Louisiana because of where they're at now.
Yeah.
Just in terms of their survival. And that comes through loud and clear. Even if it's just the subtext to some of those interviews, there's this feeling of, are we even going to be here 25, 30 years from now?
That's what I'm interested to see is... You know, like, something like Terror in the Sky has its subtext is a lot louder. And this one, there's a very quiet subtext throughout the entire movie. And it's more than one line, like one thread. There's multiple subtextual things to read into throughout the film. You know, like, it's that the town is dying. It's that the town didn't choose to embrace this story at any point. And I feel like it could have been a very big boon to their tourism. And just different, you know, like there's things, you talked about the evolution of a story, you know, with time and how film and cinema can play into that. And that is very overt. I mean, it opens with those lines, with those quotes at the beginning for that reason. But part of the reason we put those quotes in there is, like, I'm just afraid people aren't going to get that. You know, like, get that we are aware of those things and this is telling that story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm interested to see. There's also something interesting about getting to know the fake Hollywood or not Hollywood, but B movie versions of these characters. And then especially Edgar, and then seeing the grave of the real person at the end of the movie, that I'm interested to see if that connects with people or not. And it connects to me, but I was there. It was in Louisiana, and like that hit me when I was there. Like that character, I came to know Edgar, not through the real Edgar, but through this B movie character version of him. So when I see that grave, I'm not necessarily connecting that grave to the real Edgar, but it's weird. 'Cause like, it's almost like the character becomes the real person. There's this strange cycle happening there.
Sure. Sure.
I'm interested to see if other people start talking about that kind of stuff, or if, you know, like, so far the reviews have all kind of talked a lot about how fun it is and scary. And, you know, like it's a very innovative way of telling the story. And I'm interested to see if some of those smaller things get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, it is. To me, that's so impactful when you see the gravestone at the end. Mm. And at the very least, I think it does drive home the point that this was a real person. And there's some great news clipping and some great way of that's used in an artistic fashion, that you do see the real Edgar, and just makes it, you know, it grounds that at the end in the documentary portion, that, you know, whatever stories are out there that exist about this man, he was a real man, and he had a family, and then he cared about, and weird things happened, and he's not here anymore to tell that story. I don't know. That's one of the, to me, it's a super strong, yet subtle way to end that film. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys sort of just discovered.
Oh yeah,
the gravesite, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were filming. So we were filming one of Lyle's monologues, and we just needed a location. We had been to the graveyard earlier to shoot the end of the movie. The ending of the movie was actually shot earlier in the day, and we came back there because we were like, "Well, you can see, you know, you can see the hill, you can see Mars off in the background and stuff. So we'll put him there, and then we'll shoot him from the neck up, so you won't even be able to see that he's in the graveyard." So we shot that entire scene there, and then we wrapped and. Jason looked down behind Lyle, and maybe like 30, 40 feet away, is a little further than that, and like 20 yards away, 30 yards away. And they're on the 20, 30 yards, isn't that? Never mind. Anyway, right behind him, direct his eye line, or where he was standing, like that line. If you looked at Lyle and then looked behind him, there was their graves. They've also lost a couple of the kids, and they're all buried there together. So Betty, Edgar, two of their daughters, I think, are all buried right there. And that was just a coincidence. Like, we just happened to be filming there. So there was, and that was really powerful, like weirdly powerful, because like I said, you feel, you would understand this too, is like, you wrote that character, like in a weird way, you feel like you know them, maybe, even though what we were doing is we've been talking about this, but the movie is taking real events and just slightly heightening them or changing some of the details. It isn't wholesale creating a story. We know that events similar to what happened in the posse scene happened. In fact, like it might have been more over the top in reality in some ways, because there was like the guys that were having coffee and the voice asked if it could have coffee. Yeah. And there's things that we didn't even do in the movie,
right,
that almost seem more over the top. But they're based on, everything's kind of based on real events. It's just slightly heightened. Mm-hmm. You know, like the picnic scene at the beginning feels like an old 1970s slasher movie for a reason. I mean, it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But those events happened in a way that is similar to what we portrayed. It's just taken, we're just portraying it through the lens of like a 1970s mm-hmm. slasher movie.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of the interesting things about the movie is what happened with the Harrison family is similar to what we portrayed. We're just doing it in a way that is reflective of the pop culture at that time.
Yeah. And I wanted, you know, and both of us as dads, writing Edgar, you wanted him to be understandable, you know, why he would do the things he did. It's for his family's sake, ultimately.
That is one thing we lose in cutting out that scene with the boys.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was originally in the script, the scene where the boys, and that was, again, based on a real event. The boys were fishing. They saw something lumbering off out of the water and up the trail away from them. In our movie, it was going to be a little more like the monster came out of the water at them and they all mm-hmm. run off or something. But when there's a scene that immediately followed it where Edgar greets the boys after they've come back from encountering the monster, and it was a very dramatic scene where he's screaming and yelling at them about how they put themselves at danger and in danger and all this stuff. And then he's got a very dramatic scream into the woods. It was a great delivery. Like we lost a lot in that sequence, but that is one of the things that became very obvious. Like his sole intent is to keep his family safe mm-hmm. at that point. What else do we have to sum this up?
I think this is something we should probably talk to Brandon about, but his score for this.
Oh yeah.
Just it was perfect. I thought it captured the type of stuff that we absolutely wanted.
And he had to do three different scores is uh-huh. the other thing we should, and he did it as three different scores. He actually broke the movie up into chunks and then would compose the entire, he called them suites, and would compose the entire suite at one time. So he did all of Lyle's sequences at one time, then he did all the documentary at one time, then he did the narrative.
Yeah.
And Lyle's sequences have this like twang and kind of like, he said what he did is he imagined that Lyle, the Blackburn of Blackburn's Cryptid Case Files, and his buddies would just get together in their garage and jam that out. So they're just jamming and putting them together the music for those sequences. And that's why those scenes sound the way they do. It's just him and his buddies coming up with the music on like a Friday night, so Lyle can put it on his cable access show. Yeah. And then he did the documentary in the way that he would do a normal STM documentary. It sounds very Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. It's mm-hmm. kind of like a lot of synth, like Stranger Things kind of stuff. Yeah. And then he did the narrative portion of the film. And the crazy thing about the narrative portion, I thought I knew what he would do with it. Mm-hmm. I thought he would really full synth, full like 70s synth sounds and stuff. And it's not that at all. It's, he apparently like really watched Creature from Black Lagoon, which I thought was an interesting starting point. And then he expanded from there and brought in like some John Carpenter and Goblin, I know was talked about at one point. So there's some other stuff that he drew on, but it is a incredible score.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah, almost everybody watches the finished form of the movie, obviously. But when you see it, kind of from the very beginning, you know, the rough cut, and you see the layers being added. This one, especially the music, did something mm-hmm. striking, especially for the narrative portion.
Yeah,
you know, and it made it cinematic. Is the best way that I can describe it. It went from just a film of people we know acting mm-hmm. to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing the way that it functioned.
Yeah. As long as we're doing that too, we got to talk about Santino's work. Santino did some great stuff on this, and understated. I think a lot of it, it's not, again, like, I think the effects work in this one. It's not in your face or anything like that. And there's none of those, you know, like animated sequences or anything, but, some really cool effects work. It even like the opening scene with the girls in the car,
like there's
just some cool stuff that people might not even connect with effects. I mean, we're talking about like, there's a muzzle flash. That's an effect. There's lights on a car, headlights on a car pulling into a driveway. Mm-hmm. But we shot that during broad daylight on a very bright day, and there were no headlights on. So, and Santino added those in post to help bring the scene to life. So there's a lot of stuff that Santino does that I don't think people even understand at the time. Santino's going to play a vital role moving forward, especially as he moves into a sort of a larger part in the production. But yeah, there's going to be more talk about Momo, and I'm really excited to get like, I'd like to get an episode with Lyle together where we kind of talk about the case and then also his part in the creation of the project. And then I do want to get some of the actors on here to kind of talk about.
Definitely.
That.
Yeah.
Maybe even try to get like Cliff and Bobo to call in or something. Mm-hmm. So, all right. You can see the movie tonight, midnight, Kentucky Theater, downtown Lexington.
Only 5 hours away from Northeast Ohio.
Yeah. If you're in Northeast Ohio and don't want to drive 5 hours, you can watch it at the Canton Palace Theater on Friday, the 13th of September. Canton Palace Theater, September 20th at the State Theater. And that's a free screening, but it's in a very hot room. So, all right. Thanks for tuning in.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.